It's not often that a single person's life can reveal the dramatic social and political shifts of a community. From his youth, John Papa'i'i, an important statesman and author, played a pivotal role in shaping and supporting the 19th century Kingdom of Hawaii. In Facing the Spears of Change, The Life and Legacy of John Papa'i'i, Marie Alohalani Brown carefully traces the contours of his biography with nuance and beauty. The book is rich with detail and one of the few histories to put the vast corpus of Hawaiian language sources to use in understanding the island's past. John Papa'i'i's life also serves as a rewarding vantage point for thinking about Hawaiian religion during the early years of the Kingdom of Hawaii and the expanding influence of Christianity. In our conversation, we discuss genres of life writing, challenges of reframing Hawaiian modes of thinking into Western academic categories, Christian conversion, John Papa'i'i's upbringing, the importance of family genealogy, the Laplace Affair, King Kamehameha and his descendants, Hawaiian language sources, John Papa'i'i's productive retirement, and his lasting importance for Hawaiians today. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Now, without any further delay, here's my conversation with Alohalani Brown about Facing the Spears of Change, the Life and Legacy of John Papa'i'i.
Welcome, Alohalani. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Religion. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great, yeah. And I really enjoyed this book, Facing the Spears of Change. I think for regular listeners, it will be an interesting change of pace, both in kind of the content, but also in the approach. So I'm looking forward to kind of getting into that. But before we get into the book, we always start with a little bit about our authors. So could you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got interested in the study of religion, religious cultures, perhaps moments or mentors that were influential in shaping your approach?
Okay. Well, like many other Hawaiians, I grew up navigating two different cultures and two different belief systems. For example, on the one hand, I was raised a Catholic. And then on the other hand, though, I was also raised to respect Hawaiian gods. And the things were kept rather separate. So what actually started my interest in religion was when I was doing my MA thesis for a graduate degree in Hawaiian language. And I wanted to know more about the class of Hawaiian reptilian deities called mo'o, of which one is my aumakua, which means ancestral guardian. And so that started my research into Hawaiian religion. And then later on, when I was doing my PhD studies in the Department of Religion, I wanted to know more about John Papa'i'i, a Hawaiian historian and statesman who wrote a very long series in the Hawaiian language newspapers in the 19th century. And he spoke quite a bit about Hawaiian religion, but also Christianity. So
now, could you talk a little bit about how kind of it began to emerge? What kind of motivated you to tackle John Papa'i'i in this way? Kind of as a biography rather than kind of a broader historical approach or, you know, something like this. What made you kind of write the book in the way you did?
I'm one of the handful of scholars who can easily access Hawaiian language and who enjoys doing research in Hawaiian language archives. And I kept running into John Papa'i'i's, his name and his series, and he wrote quite a bit about Hawaiian gods. And so in the end, I decided that I wanted to write something that would have significance for Hawaiian people today, and rewriting a bit of history as well, because a lot of the treaties that have been done on things Hawaiian have been done normally from English language sources or a handful of translated works six works, which form the supposed canon of things Hawaiian, but these six works were written by four Hawaiians, and E.E. was one of them. And so I decided that it would be interesting, and it was. It just recently won an award, actually.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, now this was one of the things that I really liked about your book was you employed so many Hawaiian language sources. You kind of mentioned that this very narrow canon was used in previous scholarship. Can you talk a little bit about why you think other scholars thought this was sufficient? And then can you talk about the wide array of sources that you use to inform your project?
Okay. I think that there was, in general, in an earlier time, up until recently at least, a ignorance in general about the great degree to which Hawaiians were representing themselves in the newspapers, beginning in 1834 with the publication of the first newspaper and ending with the last issue of the last Hawaiian newspaper in 1948. So here we have, from 1834 to 1948, educated Hawaiians writing about a variety of topics. Now, in case you and your readers, your listeners don't know this, we had one of the highest literacy rates in the world at the time of the Hawaiian Kingdom. And several of many Hawaiians were bilingual, trilingual. Some of them were studying at Lahaina Luna, the seminary that was created by Queen Ka'ahumanu and the missionaries, Lahaina Luna in Maui. And so we were an educated bunch. And when scholars began writing about things Hawaiian, many of them could not access Hawaiian, and they had to rely on the handful of translated works, mostly of which were translated by Mary Kavena Puku'i. And there's something called the hen notes, the Hawaiian ethnography notes for the Bishop Museum archives. And Mary Kavena Puku'i dedicated her life, several decades of her life, translating these things. And then anthropologists and folklorists like Martha Beckwith would use those translations. And so today, of course, that is changing because we're recovering our language and our practices and things like that. So I thought that that was very important to show the wealth of our archives. It has been calculated that if you were to type out all the newspapers on an 8x10, 8x10, 8x11, double space times Roman 12, there would be well over a million pages. And some of those newspaper series, for example, there was one, it was 32 installments, and it was called Ho'omana Kahiko, which you could translate as the old religion and the ancient religion. And this was written by Hawaiian students at the seminary. All right, so that's one. And as far as resources go, well, clearly Hawaiian language newspapers, many of which have been microfilmed, and then some have gone character recognition. But what I did instead was I read every single page of every single newspaper published between 1834 and 1870, which was the lifetime of John Papa'i'i. And then I read another 2 years after that just to see if anybody was saying something about him. But then again, the missionary record, their journals, their official correspondence is a valuable record. You have to understand that the first company of American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, American Protestants, came over. They arrived on March 30th, 1820. And so from 1820 to 1870, E.E. was well known amongst them as being a she was the example of the perfect Hawaiian Christian, according to them. And so I looked at their different letters and correspondence and journals. And then, of course, that was a time, early 19th century Hawaii was a time when Hawaii was becoming a port of call, if you will. And so there's a lot of different captains' journals and other things that I looked at. So a wide variety of archives.
Now, You're looking in relation to John Papa'i'i specifically in genres of life writing.
Yes.
And so could you talk about some of the ways that Hawaiians discuss the world? What kind of image of the 19th century do they give us? And why was life writing becoming increasingly popular over this century?
Well, one of the things that I discuss in my book in the introduction, which is highly theoretical, is the different types of life writing genres that we had. Hawaiians were very interested in celebrating lives, and they did this through a variety of genres, different kinds of chants through genealogies. And then once the newspapers started and they were exposed to American European genres, Western genres of writing, they began writing their versions of biographies or autobiographies. And what I discovered actually beginning in 1834 with the first example, which was by Gideon La'anui, the first example of what we would consider or understand as Western life writing, is that even though they would profess to be writing autobiographies, it wasn't ever narrowly concerned with self, but with their ali'i, which is the ruling class. And I found that very interesting. And so one of the reasons why I thought biography would be a good approach is because you see Hawaiian history through the lens of John Papa'i'i's life. And he lived in a very interesting moment because in 1819, just after King Kamehameha I had died, the prevailing religious, cultural, political system was officially abolished. And so from the end of May until the end of March in 1820, so from May 1819 to end of March 1820, there was no official religion. This was a period of spiritual chaos for many people, and John Papa'i'i writes about it. So looking at his life actually shows us what some Hawaiians went through as they navigated this transition from one political system to another, and then from one religious system to another.
Yeah, and part of what I think also, at least for me as a reader, was valuable in this, was I think you highlight the problem of assuming the universality of analytical categories, where, you know, when we're trying to think about our own scholarship on Hawaiian culture, the preconditions that we come with might not kind of overlay in the same way.
Oh, yes.
So could you talk a little bit about or kind of maybe highlight one or two of the challenges of reframing Hawaiian modes of thinking into Western categories?
Well, one of the first things is that as a Hawaiian, I'm very much a member of my community. And it's different groups, and the groups reform, but we're all part of the larger community. And we pretty much know each other. And if we don't know each other personally, we know each other through somebody else. And so you're always accountable to your community. And we're always very aware as Indigenous peoples that any kind of knowledge that we produce can either help us or hurt us. And this has been the case for many different Indigenous peoples across place and time. And so that's the first thing you need to keep in mind when you're doing research. So there's an ethical component to it that needs to be considered. And then at one point I speak about kuleana, which can be understood as a set of rights and responsibilities that come with being Hawaiian, but also depending on your place in the Hawaiian community. And so one of the things I thought about is, okay, so here I'm going to be writing about this man who was a public figure. And I thought about it a while, and I decided it would be okay to write about him because other Hawaiians wrote about him during the time in which he lived. Because we have a saying, that is along the lines of, mai kaula'i naivi, don't put the bones out to dry. So, which means that you know, there's certain things that you don't talk about. And in the end, I decided to be quite forthright about how I portrayed E.E. and his fellow Hawaiians, even if sometimes it wasn't putting them in the most flattering light, because I wanted to have people truly understand the tensions and the difficulties that they faced. And so you have a more realistic idea of what it was like to live in this time. So analytical categories. One of the things, too, is my approach to writing about John Papa'i'i's life and about Hawaiian religion in general is that we have our own theories and methodologies for producing knowledge. And so those are the type of cultural values that I grew up with, and I blend those with my training as a Western scholar.
This is great. Now, just one more thing before we kind of pop into the details of this important figure. Perhaps just for our conversation, we can foreground religion, and you've already been doing that, but this is an important thread throughout the book. And you, as you mentioned, there are these kind of key transformations happening during his lifetime. So since many listeners will not be familiar with the kind of cultural and religious context of 19th century Hawaii, can you give us some of the kind of broader contours about Hawaiian culture and religion?
Oh, yes.
During the early years of the Kingdom of Hawaii, the changing conditions in terms of the role of the monarchs and the court in practicing religion, and then perhaps just a little bit about the kind of missionary efforts and introduction of Christianity during his life.
Oh, yes. Okay, well, to begin, the religious system was called the ai kapu. Ai refers to food and food consumption, and kapu refers to something that is sacred and therefore in need of restriction. It was the idea that eating food was sacred. And so this also saw the separation, if you will, of the male and female essence. And in any case, what happened was it required women and men to eat separately, and it prohibited certain foods to women, which happened to be the food forms that are associated with the major four male gods. So women were prohibited from eating pork, most type of bananas, most type of coconuts, and then, for example, red fish. And there were other things, of course. And so John Papa'i'i, for example, grew up in this system. And it's important to understand that this religion was actually not just a religion, it was a political system. And it was a cultural system. It affected nearly every aspect of Hawaiian life. So in 1819, when Kamehameha's widows, he had many wives, but Keopuʻolani was his sacred wife. Kaʻahumanu was a powerful woman, and she was his favorite wife. They convinced Liholiho, who went on to become King Kamehameha II, to abolish this system, and so he did. But while this happened, it actually it resulted in a religious war. You have to understand that at one point in Hawaiian culture, the rule would be given to one person, and the war god, which was called Ku Ka'ili Moku, or island snatching Ku, was given to another relative, high-ranking Ali'i. And so you would have the high priest of this great, powerful god, one of the most important gods that helped Kamehameha do the unprecedented feat of uniting all of the Hawaiian islands under one rule. And so when this happened, Kekuaʻokalani, who had inherited the war god Ku Ka'ili Moku, went to war with Liholiho's war general and lost and died along with his wife Manono. So that gives you a little bit insight into what a huge change this was. This system had been in place for countless centuries. And indeed, its origins are in mythical times with the sky god named Moakea and the earth mother named Papahanao Moku, or the island birthing stratum, who are said in some traditions to be the parents of the Hawaiian islands and Hawaiians. And there's different treaties on why Ka'ahumanu and Ke'opulani might have wanted to abolish this system, but I don't really cover it in my book. So those were the changing conditions. John Papa'i'i recalls in one of his series installments that he threw himself down at Liholiho's feet and begged him to reconsider the abolishing this religious system. You have to understand that John Papa'i'i had been the attendant to this king since they were children. They were separated by about 3 years in age, and I'i was the third generation of an ali'i family, so a high-ranking family, who had dedicated their lives to serving Kamehameha and his descendants. And other people have explained that Liholiho and John Papa'i'i were what we would call fourth cousins. But Liholiho, it's also important to understand, was considered a divine human. So this is also a changing condition. A question that I ask in my book that I could not find an answer to was, after the abolishment of the Aikapu, this religious system, in which ali'i were considered divine, the highest ranking ali'i were considered divine humans, and that you could be put to death if you broke one of the prohibitions concerning their bodies. What happened after that? I'i never writes about that. That's something that needs to be explored. So this is the condition in which the American Protestants arrive in the beginning of 1820. And what's very interesting is that when they arrived and they were able to communicate with the king, Liholiho, he granted them permission to stay in the islands for 1 year, but he directed John Papa'i'i and another fellow named Kahuhu to go and learn from the missionaries and decide whether it was worth keeping them around for more than a year. So that's an example of the kind of power that John Papa'i'i had, because had he not found their teachings valuable, he could have told the king to send them away. It would have been quite a different historical situation there.
Yeah, certainly. Now, this is great. You've kind of introduced us to kind of his early life, explained a little bit about the genealogical reasons why he was able to kind of be in communication and in close connection with the ruling elite. As he became a young adult and he's at the service of Kamehameha III, could you talk a little bit about the role Papa'i'i played at this point and some of the key developments that were happening under this kind of establishment of this new ruling power?
Right. Okay. So the first thing that Queen Ka'ahumanu did, who was the Kuhina Nui or co-ruler almost, but not quite, something like a prime minister, she made I'i the attendant to the young king. And also he was to help the king learn more about Christianity whenever there wasn't a missionary around. So right from the start, I'i was one of the first Hawaiians to become a convert to Christianity. And so Queen Ka'ahumanu early on traveled around the islands ordering Hawaiians to become Christians. Hawaiians did what their ali'i, the high-ranking Hawaiians, their rulers, asked them to do. And my colleague, Jeffrey Kapali Lyon, is currently writing an article for a local archive here about this relationship between ali'i's orders and the promotion of Christianity. what happened is because of Ka'ahumanu going around and telling everyone that they needed to become Christians, and when the young king, Kauikeaouli, King Kamehameha III, announced his intention for his nation, he said that it will be a literate nation and you will be a Christian nation. Now, what happens is several years later, Queen Ka'ahumanu dies and everything just falls apart. At this point, there were a lot of schools because literacy was an important part of promoting Christianity. And when she died, the king, just walked away from everything that he had said that he wanted for his people, literacy and Christianity. And so in the end, it's very interesting to look at what happened, because you realize that Christianity succeeded in Hawaii because the ali'i wanted it so. So missionary efforts, for example, began with literacy. And so as soon as they could teach everyone to read in Hawaiian, then they began creating schools, and then they were able to teach Hawaiians about Christianity, and they built quite a few churches. It was very, very interesting how quickly this conversion happened and how quickly the Hawaiians became a literate people. But what I discovered, and this really isn't in my book that much, but it's in an article that I wrote recently, is that there is a huge amount of evidence that shows that while a portion of the society did become Christians, there were a large number of Hawaiians who continued to practice Hawaiian religion.
So what did this look like, this kind of dual participation?
Well, some Hawaiians just went underground. They practiced it privately in their houses. John Papa'i'i went from being a acolyte to an enforcer of Christianity. He complained to Reverend Levi Chamberlain that his own cousin had turned away from Christianity and had set up an altar of sorts to worship a god associated with healing, because he was sick. And when Levi Chamberlain heard about this, he was rather distressed, because this man's wife had been one of their converts that had actually lived with the missionaries for a while. And the kahuna himself had been someone who had helped teach Christianity, but then had eventually turned away. So that's one example. Another example, which I found in the newspapers, which is not in my book, is the case of a Hawaiian pastor, and I forget which island, but he would hold his sermons and worship God. And then at the end of the sermon, according to this person who complained in the newspapers, he would say, okay, now we've worshiped the Christian God, now let's turn our attention to our ancestral guardians. And of course, the complaint was that he needed to be booted out because that was not acceptable.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. I know you don't write about this kind of broader social life so much in the book, but I had to kind of follow that lead there. Another kind of important event during Papa'i'i's kind of young adulthood is this Laplace affair, which he plays an important role in kind of navigating. Can you talk about the circumstances that led to this situation a little bit, and then how it was resolved?
Yes. Okay. Well, the ali'i had decreed that everyone would be Christian, but their brand of Christianity was Protestantism. And so when Catholic priests started arriving to Hawaii, they weren't treated very well. In fact, they were persecuted. And so the French were not happy with this. In fact, the Hawaiian word for Catholicism back in the day was ho'omana palani, or the French way of giving spiritual power. And so what happened was, at one point, Captain Laplace arrives to Hawaii, engaged in what we call gunboat diplomacy, demanded $10,000 as a deposit, if you will, on good intentions of treating French people and priests better in the future. And so he demanded a hostage, And the hostage at the time was Timothy Ha'aliliu, who was the personal secretary to King Kamehameha III, the same man that I'i had raised from childhood. And then at the time, Matayo Kekuanaua, who was the brother-in-law to the king because he had married his half-sister Kina'u, and John Pape I'i was a personal secretary to Kina'u, who was a co-regent, if you will, that prime minister of sorts. So Matayo Kekuanaua writes to Laplace and tells him, we really need Ha'aliliu. The king needs him as his secretary. So I am offering you another man of equal rank to me and Ha'aliliu. And so please exchange the hostages. Now, Laplace, I can access French. And so I went directly to read Laplace's own description of those events. And what he said was that he really admired Ha'aliliu. He found quite European, who spoke English well and who was dressed in a way and who was quite engaging. And he really enjoyed having him aboard as a hostage. And he was quite upset when they had given him someone that he termed was a missionary puppet who scowled at everything he set his eyes upon. And so he was sure that I'i was just there to do what the missionaries, Protestant missionaries, wanted them to do. I later on found out that I'i came aboard the ship, Laplace's ship, with a book of hymns and scriptures. Oh, and by the way, before I forget, I'i was one of the group of high-ranking Hawaiians who helped the missionaries translate the scriptures into Hawaiian.
Now, Papa I'i served many of the ruling elite, as you mentioned, right, growing up with one of the earliest as kind of a childhood companion. But then as he grew older, the ruling elite changed and some died. And as he grew older, he was serving or interacting with a younger ruling class. Can you talk a little bit about the type of relationship that he had with this new generation of rulers? How did they view him? And what were some kind of key moments in their relationships?
Well, all right. So this younger generation of ali'i were the children of some of the people that I had just mentioned. So Kina'u and Matayo Kekuanaua was the governor of Oahu. Their children, Alexander Liholiho, became King Kamehameha IV. Their other son, Lot, became King Kamehameha V. And then their daughter, Kamamalu, Victoria, was adopted Hawaiian style by John Papa I'i. And these students and other ali'i children went to the chief's Royal Children's School. And so there they were, it was a boarding school. They were supposed to learn Western ways and English. And then this school was run by Amos Starr Cook and Juliet Montague Cook, and their descendants are still around today. And so I'i, because he was the exemplary Hawaiian Christian, if you will, and because I'i had turned away from the old ways of being, William Richardson, another missionary, Reverend William Richardson, suggested to the king that John Papa I'i and his wife Sarai, also admired for the degree to which she was Christian, would be the guardians or attendant, the main attendant, if you will, or helpers to the cooks with these children. And at one point, there were well over 10 children. And so I'i had a hand in raising these future kings and things. And Victoria later on continued the practice of a female kuhina nui or prime minister, which had begun with Ka'ahumanu. So what happened was, you know, I'i was so busy. He was a statesman, so he participated in the Privy Council. He was a member of the House of Nobles. He traveled around the islands. He was one of the first or second Supreme Court judge. And So he was so busy. At one point, he was even a school superintendent for all of Oahu. He was constantly traveling, and he was also taking care of these young children, these Ali'i children who were used to having many, many attendants. Alexander Liholiho, the day that he arrived at school, he had, I think, at least 30 attendants. So what they were afraid of is that these attendants would keep them tied to Hawaiian culture. And so E.E. was trustworthy because he was a staunch Christian. But what happened is because E.E. was away so often, and because the Ali'i children were used to having their ways, there was a lot of tension at school. And unfortunately, Amos Cook took to punishing the children physically with either a rawhide whip, as he explains, he talks about it in his journals, or a ruler. So he would hit these children. And so later on in life, when these children come of age and take their place as the leaders in the Hawaiian kingdom, we see E.E. slowly being pushed out. And I hypothesize on the different reasons why this might have happened, which is really quite sad, because E.E. was above all loyal to those he served. And it might have been because he wasn't there to protect them from this physical punishment, but it might have also been because he was so old-fashioned in his ways, a certain idea of how things should be done in a way that had worked for Hawaiians for many generations, and they were a new generation, and they wanted to do things differently. So it might have been also that E.E. was an inconvenient older man who wouldn't let them usher in a time of change.
Now, in his retirement, Papa E.E.'s life was perhaps even more magnificent in many ways in terms of the activities he was involved with. Can you talk a little bit of what his life looked like after his political career, I guess we might want to call it, ended, and the types of motivations that shaped his final years?
Okay. Well, just before he retired completely from political life, the Hawaiian Evangelical Association asked him if he would go to the Marquesas. They had a mission there, and try and bring back some people from the Marquesas to come and become Christians in Hawaii, to learn literacy and do everything that they could, so that when they went back, they could help promote the word of God. So E.E., here he is, I think he was about 68 at the time, 67. And so he went to the Marquesas for 2 months, and they came back with more than 10 people. And so he continued dedicating himself to helping the mission, even after long after the kings he had served, such as Kauikeaouli and Liholiho, had died. And then at one point, it was really unfortunate. He, his first wife, Sarai, he had gotten together with her when he was about 22, so in 1822, and they were partners up until her death, I think, in about the mid-1850s. But in any case, he married four times. And more than anything, he wanted children. And there's a moment when he writes this eulogy for Queen Kina'u, for Kina'u. And he tells about the story of when he was her personal secretary, as I mentioned earlier, and she was also a staunch Christian. And she says, you know, I don't think I can have children anymore, and I'm really sad about that. And he says, well, I don't think I offended God early on in my youth. He gave me and Sarai a child and then took it away. And then they made a promise to each other that should she get pregnant again, she would give the child to John, Papa E.E. and Sarai to raise. And then she would feed the child, of course, with her body. And so, but this is important because later on, with his fourth wife, 2 months before he died, he finally became a father and the child survived. And it's really heartbreaking because he was so happy. And the newspapers talk about him bringing this child to town because he had retired to his lands outside of town. And here's this man who is just incredibly happy, blessed to have this child named Irene. And she was just 7 months old when he died. And she ended up, you know, he had spent his entire life raising other Ali'i's children. And then he dies when his daughter is 7 months old, and he doesn't, she's not even talking then. So he didn't even have the pleasure of her saying, I love you. And then when she's 7 years old, her mother dies and she becomes an orphan and ends up being raised by two different men. One is a Reverend Hyde, and the other one is the son of Dr. Judd, who was, I think, in the second or third company of American missionaries, who was a colleague of John Papa'i'i's. So it was beautiful and sad at the same time. And at the end of his life, John Papa'i'i became a pastor of sorts, if you will, preaching sermons in his in Eva, on his land. So, but one of his greatest achievements, really, after he retired, was that he had a lot of free time and began writing his different series. So we have over 70 installments where he gives an eyewitness account of beliefs and belief-related practices, historical vignettes on people. It's really incredible. We're so fortunate. And then we can also see the degree to which Christianity shaped him.
Now, in the closing of your book, you talk a little bit about the legacy of Papa'i'i. How would you say people should remember him today? What is his importance for Hawaiians?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, let's see. You know, we have the advantage of knowing how it turned out. He was fighting, him and his fellow Hawaiians were fighting so hard for Hawaiian independence, to show the world that we were a civilized people, that we were literate, that we were Christians, because that was one of the prerequisites for being civilized. And they had faced these different diplomatic incidents, always fighting this gunboat diplomacy with Great Britain and America and France. And they survived all of that. He did everything he could to help his ali'i and his people survive. So in the end, what happened, of course, is that in 1893, Queen Lili'uokalani, who had been a student at the school where John Papa'i'i had served as an attendant, assisting the cooks, she was overthrown by a small group of missionary descendants and American businessmen. And then we became a republic, a territory, and now we're the 50th state. And so when we look back, we see the way that John Papa'i'i and other ali'i navigated these periods of great change. And that is very important for Hawaiians today to realize that we survived that and that we will survive this. And what's important right now is in that period when we were being told that we were pagans and heathens for practicing Ho'omana Hawaii, Hawaiian religion, many of us are re-embracing the old ways. Some of us never stopped. And so that's coming back to life now, and we're not feeling bad about it. Knowing your history, what's happened to your people, is very, very important for healing from historical trauma, from that intergenerational trauma. And that might be hard for some people to think about how that can be so when these events, the overthrow was in 1893. But let me give you an example from my own family. Is my great-grandmother was born the year of the overthrow. And so her mom had to navigate that period. And then my great-grandmother passed away when I was 17. And typical of Hawaiian families, we knew her quite well. She would take turns staying with different of her children, one of which was my grandmother. And so I actually inherited her Hawaiian language Catholic manual. It's very interesting. And it was because she had made a prophecy that I would be her first grandchild to speak Hawaiian. And so she gave me her Catholic manual. And that was my inspiration for going on to learn Hawaiian. So it's something that's not far removed from us. You know, from John Papa E.E.'s earliest childhood until the day he died, he was strongly motivated by an innate sense of justice, you know, a generous spirit, and a heightened awareness of the importance of kuleana. And so these are things that we can still relate to today. And I find him inspiring. And coming to know his life and writings has taught me important lessons about facing challenges and changes at the personal, familial, social, political, intellectual, spiritual, and physical levels. You know, his life is an important reminder of what it means to be Oʻiwi, or Hawaiian, in the face of great and often rapid changes. And he lived his life in accordance with cultural values that our Hawaiian ancestors have handed down through the ages, which means upholding our various responsibilities, having a good work ethic, valuing learning and the arts of listening and speaking well, making the effort to improve ourselves, and striving to be good people, you know? So he became real to me, as real as it is possible for someone to be. He died about 90 years before I was born, but I actually feel like I know him.
Well, it's a fabulous book, one I really enjoyed reading, and I hope some listeners will check it out and get a copy and look through it. Obviously, there's a great detail we did not get to cover here, but I think these kind of broader contours certainly will interest some folks. So before we let you go, though, can you tell us a little bit about some of the stuff you are working on now?
Oh, yes. So I've continued my work on that class of Hawaiian water deities, which were, they were so important in the earlier time in Hawaiian society. You have this class of Hawaiian reptilian water deities called mo'o. And some were honored as war and politic deities. They were often fish pond guardians because they were thought to attract fish. Some of them were ancestral guardians, like in my case. And so they held a variety of roles in Hawaiian society. And so they are also thought to mate with humans, which is how we have them as ancestral guardians. And they're actually really fascinating. They embody the life-giving and death-dealing properties of water, the element with which they're associated. And so right now I'm wrapping up that book, which I will publish with UH Press, the same press that I published Facing the Spirits of Change. I'm really excited about that book because, you know, reptilian deities have been around for a very long time. You can find them around the world in different cultures. And so mo'o continue to be important today for many many Hawaiians. They're often associated with the continuity. So that's one thing I'm working on. I'm also continuing to do my work on the continuity and dynamicity of Hawaiian religion, which, as I said, I had an article. It's called Mauna Kea, Ho'omana Hawaii and Protecting the Sacred, which was published in the Journal for the Study of Religion, Nature, and Culture. And that's going to be my third book. It's just very interesting to look, because when we stop and think of it, there's a little bit of a bias happening with Hawaiian religion, is because people just assume that what is traditional is something that is reified. And so my goal is to raise awareness, especially from my folklore training, about what tradition really is. And so, you know, even Christianity, if you will, has undergone its own transformation and evolution, as have other religions. So that's an aspect of Hawaiian religion I want to explore, and how these different practices, beliefs, and belief-related practices in Hawaiian history have continued until this date. And so that's something that I'm working on right now.
Yeah, it sounds like you're very busy.
Yes, I am. But I love it.
Yeah. Well, good luck with everything, and perhaps we'll be able to talk to you about one of those books down the road.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That was my conversation with Marie Alohalani Brown about Facing the Spears of Change, The Life and Legacy of John Papa E.E., published with University of Hawaii Press in 2016. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion.